Okay, I'm going to go ahead and get started. And we may have some more folks filter in here. As a reminder for anybody who may have been, I don't know, in Florida for the last few weeks, the last 3 weeks of the Bible study are currently on the website, on the church website. So, if you really want to hear me talk for 4.5 hours, you can download all three of them and listen to them back to back. I personally would not, but... Tonight we're going to be starting at the beginning of chapter 17 in Deuteronomy, picking up where we left off. Okay. And... you know, by means of quick review, as I've said at the beginning of, you know, as we've been going through Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy is Moses' parting oration to the people of Israel as he's preparing to die and as they're preparing to go into the Promised Land, where he's going back and reviewing and summarizing and applying and teaching all the things that he received from God in the last four books that we read, the first four books in the Pentateuch. Okay, and tonight we're going to get into another one of the issues. If you remember last time, I talked about it again, and in the first lecture I talked about how a lot of scholars now want to date Deuteronomy late. And say it was sort of written by someone other than Moses, in Moses' name, centuries and centuries after Moses lived. We're going to sort of get into the crux of that in what we're going to read tonight. And when we do, the crux of that issue also deals with some very important issues in terms of the New Testament and the Gospels, and how we understand who the Gospels are saying that Jesus Christ is. So that's coming up tonight by way of a teaser. Let's go ahead and get started in 17 verse 1. Do not sacrifice to the Lord your God an ox or a sheep that has any defect or flaw in it, for that would be detestable to him. Now, we talked about last time how in Greco-Roman sacrifices, for example, they burned the bones. They basically burned the useless parts. And even the ancient Greeks who wrote comedic plays made jokes about that fact. It seemed obvious even to them that, you know, something's going on here. We keep all the good parts and sell them and give the gods the crummy parts we don't want. That seemed fishy. So this is, you know, God's command is quite the opposite. Again, as we saw going through and looking at the offerings and the sacrifices, God expects our first, our best. We give first, and then we live and spend and enjoy what's left. We don't live and spend and enjoy and then give what's left. But also an important point here, and this relates back to something that got brought up in the last lecture. In the last lecture, I mentioned the canon and the apostolic canons that says that a person who refuses to drink alcohol or have relations with their spouse or eat meat on a feast day is anathema. Because they've blasphemed God's creation. They've taken something that God created as good and they've said there's something evil about it. Well, the question was brought up then about asceticism, right? We have monastics, for example, who don't go out and consume a lot of alcohol. Obviously, they're celibate, so they don't have spouses, you know. And in many cases, their diet is a fasting diet. They don't eat a lot of meat either, for that matter. Okay. Well, part of how we understand that, at least in the Orthodox Church, the Western understanding of that is a little different, but in the Orthodox Church, part of how we understand that is this verse right here. If we're going to make a sacrifice to God, if we're going to give something up in our lives and sacrifice it to Him, okay, we're going to sacrifice what? the best, the good things. We're going to give up the good things, the things we enjoy most. Right? We're going to give up the good pleasures of this life. Right? We're all obviously called to give up sin and stop doing that. But if we're going to offer something as an offering to him, again, of our own free will, if we're going to offer something as an offering to him, it's going to be something good. Something good in this life that we're going to set aside for him who is something better. Okay. It's part of how we understand this. We don't go and give him the crummy lamb with the broken leg, right? We give him the prize lamb that otherwise would have been our big family feast. Okay. So that's important to understand, because especially in forms of Western Christianity, especially when it comes to sexuality, there's this idea that it's somehow tainted in and of itself. And so someone who chooses a monastic way of life has chosen a better way of life than someone who's gotten married, where there's still sort of some kind of uncleanness or something attached to even marital relations. Right? Well, St. Paul says that isn't true. St. Paul says the marriage bed is holy and undefiled. Okay? Monastics, asceticism, we don't give these things up because they're somehow bad. You know? And some of us are just too weak to live the monastic life, and so we have to dabble in the bad. No, we give them up because they're good things that God has given us to enjoy. And we give them up in order to pursue something better. Something that we want more. Okay? And that's how we understand, even in our lives, you know, when we give up things on a short-term basis. When we fast for Lent. You know, we don't fast for meat and dairy because meat and dairy are somehow bad. Or bad for us. Right? We saw God gave permission to eat all the meat you want. Okay, we give it up because we're giving up our luxury items. We're giving up some of our enjoyment to focus on something else and something better, even if it's only for a short time. So chapter 17, verse 2, if a man or woman living among you in one of the towns the Lord gives you is found doing evil in the eyes of the Lord your God in violation of his covenant, and contrary to my command has worshipped other gods, bowing down to them or to the sun or the moon or the stars of the sky, and this has been brought to your attention, then you must investigate it thoroughly. If it is true and it has been proved that this detestable thing has been done in Israel, take the man or woman who has done this evil deed to your city gate and stone that person to death. On the testimony of two or three witnesses a man shall be put to death, but no one shall be put to death on the testimony of only one witness. The hands of the witnesses must be the first in putting him to death, and then the hands of all the people. You must purge the evil from among you. Okay. Well, what's the crux here? I mean, we've heard this before. There have been several times where we've been told if someone starts following other gods or leading people to follow other gods, they've committed a crime that's worthy of death. Well, the point here that's different from the other times we've heard this is Moses is making the point that if you're going to carry this out, you need two or three witnesses, not one. Not one. Okay? One person coming and accusing someone else of something is not enough. Okay? There need to be two or three witnesses. And this actually has come forward into the canon law of the church. In the canon law of the church, if one person comes, say, for example, to Father Scott or I and says, so-and-so did this, right? They committed this sin. You need to go do something about it. And they say, nah, never happened. Canonically, we can't do anything about it. We have to have two or three.
Metropolitan Anthony Bashir's statement anytime he heard something like that was, you got pictures?
That's been carried forward into the church, right? Because you know, obviously, it's very easy for us through accusations to destroy people's lives, you know, and so this these rules that he's laying forth aren't being laid forth for that purpose, to give you a means to slander other people, to get a leg up on other people. That's not what they're there for. In fact, quite the opposite. And we're going to see in a minute, well, we'll get to that in a minute. Becky, what was your?
Oh, just a comment. And then Jesus comes along in the New Testament and says, where two or three are gathered together in my name, I am in the midst.
Right. Jesus says, where two or three are gathered in my name, there I am in the midst. And you see this pattern several times. I mean, on the Mount of Transfiguration, you have Moses and Elijah there bearing witness to Christ and who he is, right?
Peter, James, and John
are there to see the whole thing. there are three there to see the whole thing. And we already saw God at the end of Numbers, when he called heaven and earth to be his witnesses to the covenant. He said the heavens and the earth will bear witness of what happened here today. So that's a regular pattern. So in verse 8, if cases come before your courts that are too difficult for you to judge, because remember there are these judges who have been appointed in Israel to resolve these disputes, whether bloodshed, lawsuits, or assaults, take them to the place the Lord your God will choose. As we saw, that's referring to what's going to be right now the tabernacle, what's going to be the temple. Go to the priests who are Levites and to the judge who is in office at that time. Inquire of them and they will give you the verdict. You must act according to the decisions they give you at the place the Lord will choose. Be careful to do everything they direct you to do. Act according to the law they teach you and the decisions they give you. Do not turn aside from what they tell you to the right or to the left. The man who shows contempt for the judge or for the priest who stands ministering there to the Lord your God must be put to death. You must purge the evil from Israel. All the people will hear and be afraid and will not be contemptuous again. Okay. Well, what's that getting at? That's getting at the ultimate court of appeal is you go to where God himself is and the people he's appointed to speak for him. That's where you go ultimately to resolve these things. And once the ruling has been given there, it's done. It's done. This is the idea of obedience that you'll hear talked about in the Orthodox Church, because we have a similar situation with bishops. St. Paul is going to say that Christians shouldn't sue one another. We shouldn't go to civil courts to resolve our disputes. Right? That if there's a dispute, we should take it to the church, because that's the place where God is. And once, in the early church, it was usually the bishop who they would take these things to. And once the bishop resolved it, one side or the other, both sides were to follow it. Because the bishop's word was taken to be God's word on the issue. It was to be obeyed as such. Okay. And this is very, very difficult for us to do as modern Americans, where we want our freedom and we have our rights, you know, and where we have a right, first and foremost, to our opinion. And if the bishop's opinion is different than my opinion, well, what makes his opinion better than mine, you know? And can't we argue this out? Maybe I could go and publish something and get a bunch of people on my side. You know, that's not how it works in the church. That's not how it works in the church. That's not how we're called to be. We're called to be obedient. Called to be obedient even if we don't understand. We're called to be obedient even if we disagree. We're called to be disobedient even if to be obedient even if we're angry about the decision. Okay? That's what God has called us to, obedience. And St. Siloam, the Athenite, made the point at one point when he was talking to someone who was having a lot of trouble. He went to confession. He went to confession, and his spiritual father gave him some instructions, right, on how to deal with some issues that were going on in his life that he didn't like and that he didn't agree with, right? And so he came to St. Siloam, because St. Siloam, you know, was renowned, you know, as this wise and holy man, to say, you know, you agree with me, right? This guy doesn't know what he's talking about. Right? I want a second opinion. Okay. And what St. Silwan said to him was, listen, God doesn't punish sin twice. Okay. So, if what he's told you to do is wrong, let's say he's all wet, and what he's told you to do is wrong, and you obey it, he's the one who's in trouble for telling you to do the wrong thing. He said, if you go out and don't, and disobey, and don't do what he said, okay, then the consequences are on your head. On your head for what happens. Okay. So, in that way, obedience is actually kind of freeing. Right? It's kind of freeing if we can accept it. If we can listen, you know, and be willing to accept obedience and take our own will and shove it down and say, okay, you know, this doesn't make sense to me, but I'm going to do it. We can be free knowing, well, at least I was obedient. You know, we have that comfort at least. We haven't just gone out and done what was right in our own eyes. And then have to spend all the time agonizing, did I do the right thing? Should I have done what he said? Okay. So that's the key to what's being got here, is these judges aren't being set up here for your convenience. These judges are set up here so that there will be justice in the community, so that God's will happen in the community. And for that to happen, people have to obey them. People have to obey them. They can't just go to them. They have to then obey the decisions. Okay, verse 14. When you enter the land the Lord your God is giving you and have taken possession of it and settled in it, and you say, let us set a king over us like all the nations around us. Be sure to appoint over you the king the Lord your God chooses. He must be from among your own brothers. Do not place a foreigner over you, one who is not a brother Israelite. The king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them. For the Lord has told you, you are not to go back that way again. He must not take many wives or his heart will be led astray. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. This right here is that crux of the difficulty I was talking about earlier, that a lot of scholars have with the book of Deuteronomy. Because, as you may have noticed, nowhere up until this verse, up until this passage in the Pentateuch, is there anything about a king in Israel. There's no idea that they're ever going to. God doesn't tell them to have a king. He doesn't tell them he's going to appoint a king. The only kings that have been mentioned have been bad and have mostly been defeated in battle.
Well, it also talks about this one verse in there, which sounds very much like Solomon, who went astray because of all the
people. Because of the wives. Yeah. Right. Right. And it seems prophetic of some of the mistakes that those kings are going to make in terms of enlarging their wealth, in terms of having these huge harems of wives, in terms of making treaties with Egypt and with the other nations around them. And so this idea, they're going to say, well, look, there wasn't, in the Pentateuch, there's no idea of them having a king. So here this is talking about having a king. So this must have been written later when they had a king, right? And so they wrote it later, and since they had a king, they had to explain where this whole king idea came from, so they sort of wrote it back in, right? They wrote it back in as if Moses told them to have a king. Okay. Now there are a couple issues with that. The first is, even here, you notice, God is not telling them to have a king. Right? He's not saying, when you get into the land, you need to appoint a king. Right? He never says, you know, here is the role that the king has in your society. He doesn't say that. What he says is, when you enter the land the Lord your God is giving you and have taken possession of it and settled in, and you say. It literally says, and you will say. That's what it literally says. This is going to happen. Okay? You're going to get into the land, and you're going to say, we need to have a king like all these other nations. Okay? Now, lo and behold, we're going to see... We're going to see in a few months, that's exactly what happens. There's a little bit of a time lapse. There's a couple hundred years after they get into the land, but eventually they say, we need to have a king like the other nations. Okay? So that's the first point. God is not ordaining for them to have a king. Even here. He's saying, when this happens, and you decide you want a king, then he says, don't pick a foreigner, right? Pick the one who the Lord wills to be king. Don't let him start accumulating wealth. Don't let him start making foreign treaties. Don't let him start having tons and tons of wives. So nowhere in here is he saying that a king is a good thing to have. Is he saying that he wants them to have a king? Okay. He's just saying when inevitably this happens, okay? And Moses, of course, is a prophet, right? The idea is he is saying what will happen. This whole book he's been talking about what is going to happen when they get into the land and what they need to do and what he knows they will end up doing, okay? So this is restrictions and what will ultimately become the condemnation. This is what's going to condemn the kings of Israel that they're going to have. Okay? When they do have kings, it's not just going to be they're going to show up and say, you know, I don't see anything about a king in the Pentateuch, you know. You need to step down. Okay? It's not that they're Pentateuch fundamentalists, you know. It's like about a king here, we can't have one, right? They're saying, look, king, these are all the things that kings aren't supposed to be according to God. A, B, C, and D. And you are A, B, C, and D. Okay? And that continues in this instruction in verse 18. When he takes the throne of his kingdom, he is to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this law, taken from that of the priests who are Levites. It is to be with them, and he is to read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees, and not consider himself, my translation has better, it's actually literally higher, not consider himself higher than his brothers, and turn from the law, turn from the Torah, to the right or to the left, then he and his descendants will reign a long time over his kingdom in Israel. Okay. So we get another additional thing. He's not to set himself up above the other people in Israel in the sense of turning from the Torah, from this law, to the right or to the left. Meaning, he, as a king, is going to have the exact same responsibilities as far as God is concerned as everyone else. Okay. This is saying the opposite of here is the office of the king that is divinely ordained and here are his rights and privileges. This is saying the opposite. This is saying, by the way, when you guys choose to prop up a king over yourselves, he's just like everybody else as far as God is concerned. It's the same moral responsibilities. It's the same responsibilities in terms of worship. He's like everyone else. Okay. Now I'm gonna come back to this in a little bit because we're gonna get the other side of this coin in a minute here. So chapter 18, verse 1: the priests who are Levites, indeed the whole tribe of Levi, are to have no allotment or inheritance with Israel. They shall live on the offerings made to the Lord by fire, for that is their inheritance. They shall have no inheritance among their brothers. The Lord is their inheritance, as he promised them. This is the share due the priests from the people who sacrifice a bull or a sheep, the shoulder, the jowls, and the inner parts. You are to give them the first fruits of your grain, new wine, and oil, and the first wool from the shearing of your sheep. For the Lord your God has chosen them and their descendants out of all your tribes to stand and minister in the Lord's name always. If a Levite moves from one of your towns anywhere in Israel where he is living, and comes in all earnestness to the place the Lord will choose, he may minister in the name of the Lord his God, like all his fellow Levites who serve there in the presence of the Lord. He is to share equally in their benefits, even though he has received money from the sale of family possessions. Okay. So this is another little note about the Levites. As we've seen before, they don't have a land inheritance. Everybody else has this piece of land that's going to stay with their family if the rules were followed forever. That would be that piece of land for their family, because every 50 years, all the land reverted to its original owners. But the Levites don't. The Levites' inheritance is God. Okay. Now remember the promise that we read a few weeks back. The promise we read weeks back was what? That Israel itself would become a kingdom of priests. And St. Peter says that this has been fulfilled in the church, and the church is a kingdom of priests. If Israel became a kingdom of priests, so if they were all Levites, what would that mean about their inheritance? They wouldn't have any inheritance in this world. Right? In this world, they would have an inheritance of God himself. Right? Which we understand as the world to come. That's why Christians aren't looking for plots of land. Right, as our birthright from God. And that's why St. Paul in Hebrews says that Abraham wasn't really looking for a plot of land. He was looking for a heavenly promised land. He was looking for something greater. That's built in here. That's built in here. So it isn't that suddenly we get to the New Testament and now it's not about this piece of land anymore, whereas it was before. It was never really about a piece of land. That piece of land was a picture of something else that they were supposed to be hoping and striving for. Okay, it wasn't the end all and be all. And that's something that they didn't get in Christ's time. That's something that Judaism today doesn't get. It's still all about the land, and a lot of Orthodox Jews still don't believe in an afterlife. So all they've got is the land. But that misses here the whole purpose of the Levites amid the tribes. To show that there was an inheritance greater than just the land. And that they were all ultimately called to be priests for the rest of the world. In verse 9, when you enter the land the Lord your God is giving you, do not learn to imitate the detestable ways of the nations there. Let no one be found among you who sacrifices his son or daughter in the fire. That's referring to the Molech worship that we've talked about. Who practices divination or sorcery, interprets omens, engages in witchcraft, or casts spells, or is a medium or a spiritist, or who consults the dead. Anyone who does these things is detestable to the Lord, and because of these detestable practices, the Lord your God will drive out those nations before you. You must be blameless before the Lord your God. And we talked about the obviously murdering children, you know, which is the first example, but the bloodshed, the deviant sexuality, all the things that are going on in these rituals. Okay. And all of these rituals are aimed at, in some way, manipulating the gods that these people believe in. We're going to do these rituals to make it rain, or we're going to do so that we'll have fertile crops, or we're going to do these rituals so that this woman will be fertile and bear children, or we're going to do these rituals so that we'll be prosperous and successful. They're all aimed at this manipulation. Okay. Whereas God has said again and again, I'm the one who sends the rain. I'm the one who causes the crops to grow. I'm the one who blesses you with children. And I've told you what I require of you. I've told you what I require of you. Just do it. You don't need you don't need to do all these things. And they don't work. And they don't work. And they're going to lead to your destruction. Verse 14, the nations you will dispossess, listen to those who practice sorcery or divination. But as for you, the Lord your God has not permitted you to do so. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your own brothers. You must listen to him. For this is what you asked of the Lord your God at Horeb on the day of the assembly when you said, let us not hear the voice of the Lord our God nor see this great fire anymore or we will die. The Lord said to me, what they say is good. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers. I will put my words in his mouth and he will tell them everything I command him. If anyone does not listen to my words that the prophet speaks in my name, I myself will call him to account. But a prophet who presumes to speak in my name anything I have not commanded him to say, or a prophet who speaks in the name of other gods, must be put to death. Okay? So God's answer to this is, I'm going to send a prophet. You're not going to need to listen to these sorcerers, to these diviners. Okay? So I'm going to send you a prophet. And the prophet is going to speak my words to you. The prophet is going to call you back to what I've already said. Okay? You're not going to need all of this. One of the most depressing moments of my life since I became Orthodox was a woman who's been an Orthodox Christian longer than I've been alive, not anywhere around here, came up to me and said that she had visited one of these people like John Edwards, who does the cold readings where he talks to deceased family members, and how he talked to her deceased father after her father died, and that gave her so much comfort because she was just in despair. And I said, so Christ's resurrection from the dead didn't do that for you? You know, I mean, the whole basis of our faith, you know, that Christ loves you and loves your father, that your father, you know, is risen with him, and you someday will be too, and you'll be reunited. That gave you no comfort. But a guy who drew circles on a notepad and acclaimed, oh, he loves you, you know, da 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 da. This huckster, that gave you comfort. That to me is sad.
What did she say?
And kind of depressing.
How did she answer?
Well, she just kind of said, well, yeah, you know, I went to the funeral, but I didn't, you know. there was a disconnect there. Okay. But that's exactly the disconnect that is what's being gotten at in this passage. Okay. So we got out of this passage. Looking up our horoscope in the newspaper or talking to somebody like this, these kind of things, you know, for some reason, human beings find them more attractive than just the gospel of Jesus Christ. For whatever reason.
I read it and just get a big laugh.
Well, yeah, for comedy purposes, horoscopes are like fortune cookies, but the reality is that the greatness of who God is, you know, that should be what consoles us in these times. That should be who we rely on. That should be, and again, we're not different than the people at that time. We're prone to these same things. You know, we're called back to, look, you know, people all the time say, I'm trying to figure out what God's will is for my life, or I'm trying to figure out what God's will is for me to do in this situation. It's like, well, have you read the Bible about it? Have you read any writings from fathers of the church about these topics? Have you? Well, no. You know, they're looking for sort of signs, you know, or you know, for, you know, a dream to come to them and say, oh, I think I had this dream, so now I think that's, you know. God's told us what we need. He isn't playing games with us. He isn't keeping secrets. You know? He isn't sitting back watching us stumble around and chuckling. you know, while we try to find our way through life. He wants us, as he said again and again in Deuteronomy, he loves us, he wants us to live. He wants us to be successful. He wants us to follow his path. He doesn't hide it. He doesn't make it a secret. But this gets back to the obedience again. We have to be willing to go and find it and then accept it. Even if once we go and, you know, we go at whatever topic it is, we go and we do some reading and we don't like the answer we find, we have to be obedient. We have to acknowledge it once he's shown it to us and not try and obscure the issue. In verse 21, you may say to yourselves, how can we know when a message has not been spoken by the Lord? If what a prophet proclaims in the name of the Lord does not take place or come true, that is a message the Lord has not spoken. That prophet has spoken presumptuously. Do not be afraid of him. So they say, well, how do we know this is going to come to pass? Well, if the prophet predicts something's going to happen and it doesn't happen, then don't worry about him. Because he's not saying anything you need to know. And so we'll see later on, over the next couple of years, as we go through the Old Testament here, prophets will often give some kind of sign before they make their prophecy. Okay? And this is why we keep seeing people in the Gospels coming up to Jesus and saying, you know, show us a sign that what you're saying is true, that we may believe. Right? Because they get used to that pattern. You know, do something cool and then we'll know that whatever you're saying is true. You know? And most of the time when they approach Jesus in that way, Jesus is going to refuse to do something cool. You know, he's going to say, look, you've had enough signs. If you can't believe now, you can't believe. Okay, so getting back to this, we talked about this idea that there's a king is going to show up. Okay? I wouldn't call the passage we read there in Deuteronomy about the king very positive about kings. Right? But a king is going to show up. Okay? We've now also had God promise that he's going to send a prophet. That was much more positive once we know that this is the prophet that God sent. He's going to send a prophet like Moses. Okay? Now, most of the rest of the Old Testament, in the English language tradition, we break up the Old Testament by genre. Okay, so we'll talk about the historical books, right, which is like Joshua, Judges, Ruth, that are historical narratives, historical stories. And then we have the prophets, books that are named after and written by prophets. And then we have the Psalms. There we have wisdom literature like Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. We break it up by what type of thing it is. Okay. In the original, okay, there are really only two big divisions. The law, the Torah, these first five books, and then everything else is referred to as the prophets. Okay. Later on, comes to be a debate about what's included in the prophets, and so they break that into two categories, the prophets and the writings. And whatever they're kind of hazy on, they put in the writings category, and whatever they like, they put in the prophets category. Okay, but the two big, and you see this again and again in the New Testament. Christ says, all of the law and the prophets spoke concerning me. Right? Okay, so the entire rest of the Old Testament after Deuteronomy is called the prophets from that perspective. Okay, so the story of the rest of the Old Testament from that perspective is the story of these prophets. Like Moses, right? The first five books are the books of Moses, and then other prophets come. Okay? In succession. And we're going to see, even in books that are called either 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th Kingdoms, or 1st and 2nd Kings, most of 1st and 2nd Kings is about Elijah and Elisha, the prophets, not about the kings. Okay? It's really following these prophets, not the king. Okay. The most interesting thing about this is going to be when we get to the time of Jesus. Because when we get to the time of Jesus, two separate traditions have really developed in Judaism. Okay. And we see this reflected a lot of places. For example, the Samaritans and the Sadducees only accept these first five books of Moses as being scripture. Okay, both of them. When we see them talk about the Messiah, right, take the Samaritan woman at the well, Christ comes and talks to her, right, what does she get all excited about? He shows up and he tells her about her romantic past, you know, her previous husband and the man she's living with now, right? So he gives her a sign by saying that, by telling her all these things about herself that he couldn't possibly know. He gives her this sign that he's a prophet. And she runs off and says, could this be the prophet, right? The prophet, right, that we're waiting for. So this tradition develops looking for a prophet. And this particularly, and we'll talk about this obviously more in a year and a half or so when we get to Elijah, that this gets centered around Elijah. And so you'll see people coming up to St. John the Baptist. Are you Elijah? They're coming up to Jesus. Are you Elijah? And you're like, what? Because they're waiting. That's their picture of what this prophet is going to be like. Okay, they're waiting for a prophet. Okay. And the title that gets connected to this tradition that's looking for a prophet, other than this connection with Elijah, is this Son of Man. Okay? That's what God calls Isaiah when he sends him out as a prophet. It's what God calls Daniel, and then the person who Daniel sees, who is coming, is called the Son of Man. Son of Man is how it's translated in English. This obscures a little what the original is. Because you have to remember, in Hebrew and Aramaic, the word for man, as in mankind, is Adam. Adam. So literally, it's Son of Adam. Okay? And it's used in relation to the prophets to say to them that they're sons of Adam in the literal sense, they're human beings. But also, we'll see in Daniel in a few years, that in Daniel, that it's a title of this person who's going to come, this person they're expecting in this prophetic tradition. Okay? Now, a second tradition has developed at the same time. Okay? And it develops historically, and we're going to kind of see it develop. And that's a tradition that's going to be looking for a king. Okay? Now, we can see that right now, at best, you can say a king is something God knows is going to happen and doesn't necessarily endorse here in Deuteronomy. Once we get into the story of David, we're going to see where this develops from a little more. Okay? People who are looking for a king, king is referred to as the anointed one, the one who's been anointed as king. That's where Mashiach or Messiah or Christos comes from. Okay? It all means the same thing. It means anointed one. It means the king. Okay? And this tradition is going to be largely the Pharisees are going to be part of this tradition, who are going to accept all the other books of the Old Testament that talk about the kings, that talk about David, that talk about Solomon. They're going to be coming out of this tradition. And it's also going to be accepted by the Zealots, who are the political movement who are trying to overthrow the Romans. And they're going to see this king in a purely political sense. The Pharisees are going to have an understanding of the resurrection and see this king as not just a political king, but a political king plus. Okay. The title that is particularly attached to this tradition, aside from Messiah, is Son of God. We're going to see later, once there are kings, okay? When the king is crowned, part of that coronation ritual is going to be them saying, "Today you are my son, today I have begotten thee," meaning he's now the Son of God, meaning God's representative on earth. Okay? And we're going to read in the Psalms, God talking about the kings of the world. He's going to say, "You've been called sons of God, sons of the Most High, but you're going to die like men." This is a title directly connected to this idea of king. Okay? So in the Gospels, what we find is that the Gospel writers don't pick one of these traditions to come down on. They don't pick the Pharisee position. They don't pick the Sadducee and Samaritan position. Okay? They argue that Christ is the fulfillment and the unique fulfillment of both. Okay? They're going to argue that Christ is the king who's been promised, like David and descended from David, who is uniquely the Son of God, the actual begotten Son of God before eternity. Not just figuratively the Son of God adopted, but the actual Son of God. And they're going to argue that he is the prophet, the ultimate prophet like Moses, who is the ultimate son of man, son of Adam. And St. Paul, especially in Romans 5, is going to develop that a lot, the idea of Christ and Adam. Christ as a second and new Adam. So these two traditions really start right here in this passage we've just read, in sort of their nascent form, and are going to develop from here, and we're going to see both of them going on. And again, it's not that one is right and the other's wrong, it's that Christ is the fulfillment of both. That both of these are going to find their fulfillment in Jesus. Okay. Does anybody have any questions about that before we... Okay. So chapter 19, verse 1. "When the Lord your God has destroyed the nations whose land he is giving to you, when you have driven them out and settled in their towns and houses, then set aside for yourselves three cities centrally located in the land the Lord your God is giving you to possess. Build roads to them and divide into three parts the land the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, so that anyone who kills a man may flee there." These are the cities of refuge that we read about in Numbers, right? That if someone, because someone has the right of vengeance, right? If I kill your brother, you can come and kill me. If it was an accident, and I need to have a hearing before you come and kill me, so I can explain that, then I run to one of these cities of refuge so I can have my case heard. "This is the rule concerning the man who kills another and flees there to save his life, one who kills his neighbor unintentionally without malice aforethought. For instance, a man may go into the forest with his neighbor to cut wood, and as he swings his axe to fell a tree, the head may fly off and hit his neighbor and kill him." Here's a good example. "That man may flee to one of these cities and save his life. Otherwise, the avenger of blood might pursue him in a rage, overtake him if the distance is too great, and kill him even though he is not deserving of death, since he did it to his neighbor without malice aforethought. This is why I command you to set aside for yourselves three cities. If the Lord your God enlarges your territory as he promised on oath to your forefathers and gives you the whole land he promised them..." Remember, we talked about how the borders he described are not the borders they ever managed to reach. "But if that were to have happened because they had carefully followed all these laws, to love the Lord your God and to walk always in his ways, then you are to set aside three more cities. Do this so that innocent blood will not be shed in your land, which the Lord your God is giving you as your inheritance, and so that you will not be guilty of bloodshed." Okay. This is how important it is to God that innocent blood is not shed. Right? You could sit back and say, well, how often will an accident like that happen? Right? We need to build three cities. Right? Fully functioning cities. We need to go to all this trouble. this is how serious God takes the value of a single human life. That he's going to say, yes, you have to build three cities. And if the land gets too big, so there's too much distance between them, you need three more. Okay? Because not one innocent person should be killed. Verse 11, but if a man hates his neighbor and lies in wait for him, assaults and kills him, and then flees to one of these cities, the elders of his town shall send for him, bring him back from the city, and hand him over to the avenger of blood to die. Show him no pity. You must purge from Israel the guilt of shedding innocent blood so that it may go well with you. Okay. Do not move your neighbor's boundary stone set up by your predecessors in the inheritance you receive in the land the Lord your God is giving you to possess. Okay, remember, they're all going to have their own plots. Don't go out there and, you know, every day move it 2 feet to the left. <You know? laughs> Eventually, you know. One witness is not enough to convict a man accused of any crime or offense he may have committed. A matter must be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. If a malicious witness takes the stand to accuse a man of a crime, the two men involved in the dispute must stand in the presence of the Lord before the priests and the judges who are in office at the time. The judges must make a thorough investigation. If the witness proves to be a liar giving false testimony against his brother, then do to him as he intended to do to his brother. Okay? That's how serious this issue is of accusing and slandering people. So if you go and accuse someone of murder, accuse someone of some crime that they would be killed for, and it turns out you're lying, guess what?
You need to bring this back in with frivolous lawsuits.
Yeah, I was about to say, we'd have a lot less lawsuits if we practice this. Okay? But that's the point. That's the point, is to prevent this from being abused. The rest of the people will hear of this and be afraid, and never again will such an evil thing be done among you. Right? God's intent isn't for a whole bunch of people to be executed for lying in court. Once will probably do, right? The first time they hear about it, everybody will say, yeah, that's a bad idea. Show no pity, life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Chapter 20, verse 1, when you go to war against your enemies, let me stop right there. Remember, I've been talking about how addressing the issue of Israel going and slaughtering the Canaanites, just massacring all these people, letting no one live, destroying everything. Right? I've been saying, and you've been very politely mostly accepting, the idea that the reason this is happening is that God is using them as an instrument. Right? That God is judging them and he's using them as an instrument. God is not saying that going out and committing genocide is okay, given certain circumstances. Right? Now here, in chapter 20 of Deuteronomy, I'm going to back myself up here. Okay? Because chapter 20 here, God is going to talk about, he's not talking about the war they're about to fight, as we're going to see. He's not talking about when they're fighting the Canaanites. He's talking about once they're settled in the land, when wars happen, how they're to conduct themselves. Okay? We're going to see it's going to be very differently than the way they're to drive out the Canaanites. Okay? So 20 verse 1, when you go to war against your enemies and see horses and chariots and an army greater than yours, do not be afraid of them, because the Lord your God who brought you up out of Egypt will be with you. When you are about to go into battle, the priest shall come forward and address the army. He shall say, "Hear, O Israel, today you are going into battle against your enemies. Do not be faint-hearted or afraid. Do not be terrified or give way to panic before them. For the Lord your God is the one who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies, to give you victory." Okay? We've seen this point before. Right? If Israel's doing what they're supposed to be doing, okay, then God is the one who's going to give them the victory. And so they don't have to worry about it. They don't have to count troops. They don't have to. God's going to give them the victory. Verse 5, the officers shall say to the army. Now, this is something you will not hear in any modern military setting. The officer shall say to the army, "Has anyone built a new house and not dedicated it? Let him go home, or he may die in battle and someone else may dedicate it. Has anyone planted a vineyard and not begun to enjoy it? Let him go home, or he may die in battle and someone else enjoy it. Has anyone become pledged to a woman and not married her? Let him go home, or he may die in battle and someone else marry her." Again, you will not hear that before deployments in the modern military. Then the officer shall add, "Is any man afraid or faint-hearted? Let him go home so that his brothers will not become disheartened too." When the officers have finished speaking to the army, they shall appoint commanders over it. Okay? So the officers are to go to the army, God is saying, and basically tell them, anyone who doesn't want to be here can leave. Okay? That sounds insane. Well, what was the last point? What was the point of the previous paragraph? The point of the previous paragraph was, they're not winning the victory, God is giving them the victory. So it doesn't matter if they have 1,000 troops or 10,000 troops. God is going to give them the victory. So if 9,000 of the 10,000 want to go home, okay. Right? Because they'll still win. They'll still win. Verse 10, when you march up to attack a city, make its people an offer of peace. Remember, God told them explicitly with the Canaanites not to do this. Right? Canaanites, different case. He's saying in the future where there's a war and you march up on a city, give them an offer of peace. If they accept it and open their gates, all the people in it shall be subject to forced labor and shall work for you. They refuse to make peace and they engage you in battle, lay siege to the city. When the Lord your God delivers it into your hand, put the sword to all the men in it. And only the men. As for the women, the children, the livestock, and everything else in the city, you may take these as plunder for yourselves, and you may use the plunder the Lord your God gives you from your enemies. This is how you are to treat all the cities that are at a distance from you and do not belong to the nations nearby. However, in the cities of the nations the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, do not leave alive anything that breathes. Completely destroy them, the Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded you. Otherwise, they will teach you to follow all the detestable things they do in worshiping their gods, and you will sin against the Lord your God. Okay? So there's a difference here. What's going on with the Canaanites, the horrid things they've done, there's judgment coming upon them now. Okay? But that's not how the Israelites are to conduct themselves in the future. Verse 19, when you lay siege to a city for a long time, fighting against it to capture it, do not destroy its trees by putting an axe to them, because you can eat their fruit. Do not cut them down. Are the trees of the field people that you should besiege them? Right? Are the trees fighting against you that you have to go and hack down all the fruit trees? However, you may cut down trees that you know are not fruit trees and use them to build siege works, until the city at war with you falls. Well, what's that all about? That's about no scorched earth. Right? That's you don't go in, level everything, destroy the farmland, starve the people out. Right? Even in war, remember we talked about how in all other Bronze Age societies, you had the camp, and you had outside the camp. And outside the camp is where war took place. And so in war, none of the rules in the camp apply. Right? In the camp, you're not allowed to kill anybody. War, slaughter everything that breathes. Right? In the camp, you respect property. War, take what you can seize. Right? The idea that you have to conduct yourself morally in warfare is another one of these things that doesn't belong in the Bronze Age. That God is saying, even when you go to war, even if they attack you first, right? You don't get to go in, level everything, destroy everything, set it on fire, slaughter everything that moves. Okay? You have to try and make peace. And if all your efforts at peace fail, you can kill their soldiers who are fighting against you. You can't even burn down their trees. You can't even destroy their crops. Okay. Chapter 21, verse 1. If a man is found slain lying in a field in the land the Lord your God is giving you to possess, and it is not known who killed him, your elders and judges shall go out and measure the distance from the body to the neighboring towns. Then the elders of the town nearest the body shall take a heifer that has never been worked and has never worn a yoke, lead her down to a valley that has not been plowed or planted, and where there is a flowing stream. There in the valley, what is yours at? This
I call it the neck.
Okay. There's a difference here. In the Greek and the Aramaic. In the Aramaic, it says to hamstring it, essentially to make it so it can't walk, but it's left alive. That's in the Septuagint, in the Greek. In the Aramaic, it says to break its neck. So I don't know which which one you think is worse. But the idea is that this heifer is being offered as a sacrifice, either way. Okay? But it's not being sacrificed the usual way. Why? Because all of those sacrifices are going to happen at the temple. Right? That's the only place where the regular sacrifices are going to be done. So this one is different because this one is done at this place where this body has been found. Okay. Out in the wilderness. The priests, the sons of Levi, shall step forward, for the Lord your God has chosen them to minister and to pronounce blessings in the name of the Lord and to decide all cases of dispute and assault. Then all the elders of the town nearest the body shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley, and they shall declare, "Our hands did not shed this blood, nor did our eyes see it done. Accept this atonement for your people Israel, whom you have redeemed, O Lord, and do not hold your people guilty of the blood of an innocent man, and the bloodshed will be atoned for. So you will purge from yourselves the guilt of shedding innocent blood, since you have done what is right in the eyes of the Lord." Okay. Again, to reiterate, this is how seriously God takes the value of every individual human life. Okay. This is just some guy who they found out dead. Who knows what happened to him? Right? Who knows? But he's a human being. He's dead. Okay. And so God's going to hold someone accountable for his life. And so the people have to come together and offer a ransom for this poor man's life and declare that they're innocent, that they had nothing to do with it. That's how serious that single human life is. And it's important, yeah.
Is that just anybody, or is it supposed to be, do they have to be one of the Israelites?
Anybody. Not just the Israelites. Because remember, God, one of the points that's been all through here is that the alien who is dwelling among you is to be treated the same or better. Because they were aliens in Egypt. Right? Doesn't matter who it is. And this is something we need to come back to. Okay? Because a lot of times, you know, you had some pictures from Dachau prison earlier. You know, a lot of times we get lost in numbers. Right? Millions of people killed, thousands of people killed. You know, these horrible numbers. To God, there aren't 2 million people killed. Because God knew every one of those people's names. Okay? God knows every one of those people's names. He knows each one of them personally. He created each one of them. Okay? And he's told us he's going to want an account. Someday when we stand before him, he's going to want an account for every single one of them. Every single one of them. And that's something we need to take really seriously when we look at the end of our lives and we look at that judgment. Every person that we meet during the day, even if it's that grubby homeless-looking guy I brushed past on the way to the 7-Eleven to get my Pepsi. Okay? That's someone who God knows. It's someone who God created. And someone who ultimately God may ask me, what about him? What did you do for him? And most of the time we will have to say, I didn't even really notice him. I didn't really, to be honest, care about him. Okay. And again, this idea is so bizarre in the Bronze Age. So bizarre, even at Jesus' time. Even in the first century AD. This idea that God knows and cares about individual people who aren't even important people. And something we always, even if we run into 100 people every day who we don't care about, those 100 people are each individually precious to God. And something we forget all too quickly. So here in verse 10, we go back to this war, these rules of warfare. When you go to war against your enemies and the Lord your God delivers them into your hands and you take captives, if you notice among the captives a beautiful woman and are attracted to her, you may take her as your wife. Now, what you have to understand is if you're reading this in the Bronze Age, you're not expecting you may take her as your wife. Okay. If you're reading this in the Bronze Age, you're expecting more like just you may take her.
Don't you burn.
You know, right? Because for the other cultures, again, women aren't really human in the same sense men are. Okay? They're property, you can do what you want with them. Okay? Also notice, remember, they're expressly forbidden to take any of the Canaanites as wives. Again, the Canaanites, different category. They're under God's judgment. It says, you may take her as your wife. Bring her into your home and have her shave her head, trim her nails, and put aside the clothes she was wearing when captured. After she has lived in your house and mourned her father and mother for a full month, then you may go to her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. Well, what's that all about? That sounds weird. Why would you shave her head? The idea here is her head shaved, her nails are trimmed, she puts off whatever clothes she was wearing, she mourns her father and her mother, her old life, whatever it was, ends. And she begins a new life as an Israelite. As an Israelite. Married to an Israelite. Okay? She's not property. She's not booty. Right? She's now an Israelite woman. Married to an Israelite man. Verse 14, if you are not pleased with her, let her go wherever she wishes. You must not sell her or treat her as a slave since you have dishonored her. Okay. I talked about biblical feminism once before. Okay, So this is again. You find this woman who's a foreigner in a city you took, you treat her as essentially an equal. Essentially is an equal. Bizarre at the time this was written. Okay. We're still, as I said when I talked about biblical feminism, we're still trying to live up to the stuff that God told us to do 1250 BC. Verse 15, if a man has two wives and he loves one but not the other, and both bear him sons, but the firstborn is the son of the wife he does not love. That's kind of familiar. Where have we heard that before? Genesis. With Jacob and Leah and Rachel. When he wills his property to his sons, he must not give the rights of the firstborn to the son of the wife he loves in preference to his actual firstborn, the son of the wife he does not love. He must acknowledge the son of his unloved wife as the firstborn by giving him a double share of all he has. That son is the first sign of his father's strength. The right of the firstborn belongs to him. Okay. Again, you're going to have multiple wives. It doesn't matter which one you like best. man. I talked about before how these laws are all written to the people who are in the positions of power. Right? This is restricting what a man can do with regard to his wives. Doesn't matter if you like your trophy wife who you picked up later better. Right? Firstborn of your first wife. Okay? Her rights. Her rights. Because remember, when he's gone, it's the son who's going to be taking care of the mother. So her rights have to be preserved. Verse 18, if a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who does not obey his father and mother and will not listen to them when they discipline him, like my parents had. I mean, she's sitting right there, so it's not like I could lie about it. His father and mother shall take hold of him and bring him to the elders at the gate of his town. Fortunately, they didn't obey this. They shall say to the elders, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. He is a glutton and a drunkard. Now, remember, does that phrase glutton and a drunkard sound familiar?
That's
what they confuse.
Compared him with John the Baptist.
That's what they accuse Jesus of. Being a glutton and a drunkard. Being a bad son. Of all things. Okay. Then all the men of his town shall stone him to death. You must purge the evil from among you. All Israel will hear of it and be afraid. This is another one of those, you will only have to do this once. And then, but as I talked about before, the last time we talked about this with a rebellious son, who is this really punishing? Notice it says son, not daughter. This is really punishing the parents. This is punishing the parents. Because remember, your son, he's the one who's going to inherit. He's your legacy. He's the continuity of your family line. He's essentially your immortality. Okay? So this is a threat to parents, really. More than it's a threat to sons. That if they don't raise up their child in the way he should go, as Proverbs is later going to say, you know, they're going to lose him. They're going to lose him. Okay. Verse 22, if a man guilty of a capital offense is put to death and his body is hung on a tree, you must not leave his body on the tree overnight. Be sure to bury him that same day. Because anyone who is hung on a tree is under God's curse. You must not desecrate the land the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. Well, there's an obvious example of this. Right? And we celebrated at the unnailing Vespers every great and holy Friday and Holy Week in the afternoon. They come before Pilate, they say, tomorrow, we can't leave him hanging on this cross, let us take the body. Why is someone hung on a tree under the curse? Well, if someone's body is hung on a tree and left there, okay, what's not happening to it? It's not being buried. It's not being treated with care, concern. There's no family coming to claim it. It's just hanging there. What is happening to it? It's being eaten by animals, picked at by birds. So this idea of a body hanging on a tree becomes for the Israelites, and we're going to see again in Joshua in a few weeks a very pointed example of this. But this becomes the image for the Israelites of being accursed. This is the worst thing that could happen to you. This, you know, robbers or some violent men could fall upon you, kill you, and leave your body hanging from a tree. That's pretty much the worst possible fate they could imagine. Okay. This is why St. Paul is going to say that the cross you know, is shameful to the Jews. The whole image. The whole idea that you have this image of what for them is the ultimate curse, and then say, this is God. Bizarre makes no sense whatsoever to them. No sense whatsoever to them. They can't put those two together. How could the worst thing that could possibly befall anyone befall God? And not just befall him, like, oh, it happened, and we happened to walk by and see it happening, but we did it. God came to us, and how did we treat him? The worst possible way you could treat a human being. We did the most horrific thing we possibly could to him. Okay. That's the picture there. And it starts here. It starts here. And that comes to be for us as Christians now. You know, for all the unartistic goriness of Roman Catholic crucifixes, you know, there's something lost when you have one that's sort of bare, you know, and made out of gold without Christ on it. You know, you kind of forget what it is that you're looking at. You know, that what you're looking at is horrible pain, humiliation, shame. Right? You're looking at all the things that, according to Deuteronomy that we're reading, and that's going to be emphasized even more later, according to Deuteronomy, you're looking at the fulfillment of all the things that we've really earned. You know, we're the ones who have gone down the path of destruction. We're the ones who haven't followed God's teaching. We're the ones who haven't gone this way. And we see God himself becoming, as St. Paul says, becoming a curse for us. Right? So that we're free of it. So that we're free of it. Okay? And so when we look at the cross, we're looking at the image of that curse. We're looking at the condemnation of our own evil, our own sinfulness. Okay, and we're also looking at the image of the God who was willing to suffer that and take that on himself, to spare us, to save us, to restore us. And that's another thing that we're too quick to forget. Far too quick to forget. So I think this may be a good spot to wrap up tonight. It's the end of chapter 21. Okay. And so next time we will endeavor to go through from chapter 22 through the end of chapter 28, though we may only get through chapter 27. But we'll try to do at least 22 through 27, and then possibly 28 if you want to read ahead a little and get some extra credit. In 2 weeks, yes, I forgot. Next week is the dinner. So please come in and eat at some point earlier in the afternoon. But we won't be having Bible study. So in two weeks, 22 through 27, 28 for extra credit, brownie points. Does anybody have any questions before we go?
When you were talking about hanging on the cross and about no families, what came to mind immediately when you said that? Was I was doing some survey, and I came across a cemetery that was a pauper's field, and all of the people buried there were prisoners from the mounts of penitentiary who had died there. And when you looked at it, I mean, it was like there was a state road sign that no name on it that was there, you know. The ground had sunk in, there was water. It was just like an animal. You know, we've got to take care of it. And I really felt very bad that the families would not claim the money or anything.
Yeah.
It was a very depressing type thing going through that. We ended up, didn't know what it was until we saw the state road signs and then looked. That's what it was.
Well, and that's the sad truth. In L.A. County, they have a whole bureau that all they do is if someone dies and no one comes to claim the body, they go and search their home and they try and find someone, some relative or something to come claim the body. And the average year in Los Angeles County by itself, between 2,000 and 3,000 people never have their bodies claimed. Okay. And what happens is they all get cremated and they get brought to this field and all there is there's a year marker. And a Protestant minister who I have immense respect for doing this goes out there and does a prayer service for all of these people whose names we don't know in a lot of cases, you know, who you know, and says something for them. But we as Christians have our work cut out for us in that respect. Because like I said before, you know, God's going to ask us about those people. And if there's one thing that Christians are called to, completely clearly in the New Testament, it's to visit the sick, visit those who are in prison, visit those who are alone, who are isolated, who are unloved, and bring the love of God and the love of Christ to them. I mean, if there's one thing God wants us to do, that's it. You know? And so, yeah, it's staggering, but That's what we're called to do. And we need to be woken up to that every so often. You know, and so we see those things and it is sad, but it should also prod us to doing what we need to be doing. Does anybody else have any? Okay, well thank you everybody for coming tonight. And I'll see you next week. Eating. Stuffing food in my mouth, and then I'll see you in 2 weeks here at the Bible study.